Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 Whiskey Golf Bravo, KC2 WGV. John and Dick attempt to run something called the Technical Net. We gather amateurs most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock to discuss our favorite subject, ham radio, and almost all the things connected to it, and also space hardware. Tonight we probably will have a significant discussion by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, as to the great things that have been taking place with the Mars Science Laboratory, better known as Curiosity. As you guys probably know, it landed last Sunday evening by our time, but really Monday morning, I guess at around 1:30 a.m. Local time, and it's been doing great things, and it's got one hell of a future. And it went through a very difficult 7 minutes of terror, encountering the Mars atmosphere and going through six different configuration changes and landing itself on a sky crane after parachutes and everything else. Very, very successful project. So we're going to be hearing about that. We're also going to be hearing about, a carryover from last week from Rich N2EO on his question with reference to link coupling. Let me drop. And I know also that Vito, WA2PJF, wants a further discussion on space subjects. So Vito and Rich are already signed. And a person signs into the Technical Net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just to say you're listening. After 29 years, we believe somebody is listening. You can go to the website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you can listen to the last 6.5 years worth of Technical Net recordings. And occasionally the recordings are a little bit noisy, like last week, but I'm pretty sure that Mike will eventually correct that. He had some antenna problems last week. The usual procedure for the TechNet is that during the first hour, John and I try to make a sincere effort to at least give a brief answer to people's question. After that, it's followed by John's mailbag, which used to be called Mel's mailbag, in which people who don't yet have a license are able to send in questions by snail mail or email, and we choose two or three of those to answer. The majority of what the TechNet does is a live give and take. John and I are not promising a written consulting service that's above and beyond the call of duty, but when it comes to people asking a question directly and tapping into all that brain power that exists in the tri-state area around New York City, which is covered by this particular repeater, W2VL, the Limark repeater, stands for Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, we try to tap into that brain power, and people usually get an answer. No guarantee it's always going to be 100% accurate, but there's a kind of a peer review going on. People listen. People listen to the website, and when we make serious errors, they bring it to our attention, we bring it to your attention. So the answer hopefully eventually gets accurate, even though it might not be at first. But as I said earlier, the price is right, and hopefully you're getting what you paid for. The one other thing I'd like to cover tonight, after we do the usual 1 hour's worth of questions and answers, the approximately a half hour or so worth of mailbag information, and there's going to be at least a half hour, 45 minutes or more on space material with reference to the Curiosity spacecraft, the Mars Science Laboratory, that Paul will be telling us about, WS2N. After that, let me drop. After that, I'd like to give all 15 or 20 minutes on the subject of what really is an inductor, a coil, a transformer. I've been hearing people over the last few weeks discussing transformers in ways that lead me to believe that there's a lot of misunderstanding. The seemingly simple component, a filter choke that's used in a power supply, an inductor, or when you add a secondary winding to it, and you and I call it a transformer, and how does it really work? Where is its efficiency, and what kind of waveforms can it reproduce, and whatever. What is back EMF? What is inductive reactance? I've got another way of looking at inductive reactance, as I said, I think there's a definite need for a little more understanding on that subject, so I'm going to give a little extemporaneous 15 to 20 minutes worth from my point of view, in which you guys can say, hey, what do you mean by that? Does it really act that way? How come it's different than the formula everyone else is giving us?
Beautiful.
So I've got my own way of covering that particular subject. And I think that's going to help, because lots and lots of misunderstandings. I remember in the days when I first built myself a transistorized power supply, when you couldn't go to a Radio Shack, it didn't exist. You went to Lafayette Radio and you bought some kind of a transformer, and you rewound it in order to try to get 15 volts output AC to run a bridge rectifier, to get a 12-volt regulator to run my transistorized transmitter I was building at that time. Things like that didn't exist. I had to wind my own transformer. And my goodness, was that an educational process. I was studying electrical engineering at college at the time. I thought I understood what's going on. There's a lot more to it than meets the eye. So a little bit of that information as to what I've gained in that process of hands-on transformer winding, building, and understanding them, it says here. I'm going to give you a little bit of that before we get rolling with the more serious stuff. That's serious enough. All righty. A way a person signs in, as I said, you give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign in would sound like this. KC2RFN, Alan and yes. Alan, as you may know, is the man who nominated the TechNet for a ARRL prize, which it won 2 years ago. Okay. Give me your call letters and name. As I said, Vito and Rich, N2EO, and WA2PJF have already signed in. Who else do we have? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
KC2ER Angel, yes.
Okay, Angel, KC2ER, it sounds like. KC2 Echo Romeo. I bet you there's a third letter there, Angel. Go ahead.
KC2ERR.
Okay, Echo Romeo Romeo is Angel. We got you. You're the third on the list. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
And to XGN, article.
We got Wes. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name.
W2 Tango Echo Charlie. Chris, no question.
And WS2N is here. Good evening, Dick. Paul with the Space Report.
And Paul, when it comes to Charles, I guess, Chris. Chris, we got you. Paul, when it comes to the Space Report, did anything significant happen this week?
Nothing I can think of, Dick. Back to you.
As you can tell, we're kidding each other. One of the biggest, something about second or third right behind the Hubble Space Telescope is going to be this Mars Science Laboratory, I think. We'll soon find out about that. Okay, Vito is the first guy on the list, and Vito was asking the question last week about the end of the world type stuff. As you know, the Mayan calendar runs out, and other people are making various predictions that the planets are all going to line up, and the Earth is going to crash into a whole bunch of volcanoes and tornadoes and everything else. It's going to be cats and dogs fighting each other. All kinds of bad things are going to happen if you want to read some of the sensationalistic articles. And so Vito was asked about that a little bit last week, and I think he's got a somewhat similar question this week. WA2PJF. The radio voice of Bayshore, K2RIW. Go ahead, Vito.
Well, good evening, Professor. I have to call you Professor. You certainly are. You copy me okay before I go any further. Go ahead.
You sound real good. So go right ahead, Vito.
Okay. Part two of last week's questions. Didn't want to take up too much time then. Rumor has it, the planet Nibiru, I'm not sure of the correct pronunciation, N-I-B-I-R-U, is believed to be heading towards the planet Earth. Supposedly, it is now hidden behind the sun. The same planet Nibiru, that's the correct pronunciation, is the ancient Arcadian name for the planet Jupiter. Now, what can you tell me about this scenario? Do we have any issues with this? Do we have to be concerned? Back to you, Dick. Go ahead.
you go to a website called spaceweather.com, I think it is. I think it's called spaceweather.com. On their page, they give you a lot of good information. Near the bottom of the page, they give you the list of the near-Earth objects that have been detected. There's more and more people setting up telescopes, looking for everything out there that hasn't already been identified. Are there comets? Are there asteroids? Are there various things heading for us? These near-Earth objects, NEOs, they've got the latest list. They tell you in the lunar distances, in other words, a quarter million miles roughly between Earth and Moon, if you use that as a yardstick, how close are each one of these things going to come to us? When are they going to come to us? You know, what date, what hour, and how close? So the best list there, done by people using real equipment looking for these things, is one of the best references I think you're going to find, Vito. If something is behind the sun, let me drop. You may or may not know there's something called the Lagrange point. In other words, if I've got a third object that's in some kind of an orbital characteristic with two other objects, in other words, I could use the Earth as the primary object, the Moon as the secondary object, and I could put a third object in orbit around either of those. That third object, there's a number of places where you can form a stable or unstable orbit with it. They're called Lagrange points. And so at the exact same distance as the Moon, quarter of a million miles out, and at an angle from the Earth compared to the Moon of 60 degrees ahead of the Moon or 60 degrees behind the Moon, there are two Lagrange points. You put something there, and it'll stay there in orbit, and so the three things will be in orbit around each other. I think that's Lagrange point number 3 and 4. There's a Lagrange point on the far side of the Earth, the opposite side of the Moon from the Earth, opposite side of the Earth from the Moon. There's another Lagrange point on the far side of the Moon. And so all of these places where something could be located have been identified by these Lagrange points. So if I now don't look at the Earth-Moon system, I look at the Earth-Sun system, we've got a Lagrange point that's roughly a million miles out further from the Earth. We've got another Lagrange point that's a million miles toward the Sun, away from the Earth. And we've got SOHO and other satellites in that location. And I don't know whether or not we've ever placed a space project, a object, on the far side of the Sun. But if it was on the far side of the Sun, it would be roughly the Earth's distance from the Sun. So these possible places of locating a planet, an asteroid, a comet, a spacecraft, these Lagrange points are pretty well identified. In order to take something that's hiding behind the Sun, let me drop. I'm not sure if that's Lagrange point number 1 in the Earth-Sun system, but that particular Lagrange point of something located behind the Sun, to move it from that location where it's hidden by the Sun most of the time from us, and then move it in such a way that it's going to hit the Earth, boy, that's going to take a lot of energy. Somebody's going to have to use a whole lot of rocket power to move it out of Lagrange point number 1 and try to get it into the one of the trajectories where it can hit the Earth. So this particular mysterious planet, is it really there? Is it really going to suddenly move? And is it going to hit us? I doubt it very highly. I think it's a much higher probability that something is going to come out of the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt. These are these clouds that are way beyond our solar system. And suddenly one of these is going to come roaring toward us. But with all of those telescopes looking for unidentified objects, these near-Earth objects, would it escape that net of telescopes that are now looking for objects, and we're not going to detect it until it's too late and it's going to come hitting the Earth? Not impossible, but it's a real long shot as I see it, Vito. There's lots of things you and I can worry about. I just don't think that's a major one. And I'll admit that.
Dick WS, and you got the stereo spacecraft looking at it. No problem.
Hey, give us some words on that, Paul. Tell us about stereo and what is it looking for? What has it seen? Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I haven't read much about it in quite a while, but the stereo A and B, it will launch. One is like drifting in front of us, and one has been drifting behind us, oh, I don't know, a million miles a month or something, whatever it is. And right now, I mean, it's been so long since they've been launched. They're at, last time I looked, about a week ago, they're about 120 degrees away from each other, and then in reference to us, about 120 degrees. So, in other words, if you were to put the sun in the middle and you follow the Earth's orbit around, go out from the Earth, you know, from the center of the sun, 120 degrees off, that's stereo A and stereo B is the other way. But, you know, these things would detect anything like that. It's basically looking at the sun, studying the sun's mechanism, you know, how that works and all. Back to you.
So the main thing are these solar-like telescopes, probably coronoscopes, are looking at the sun at various angles. So we get a three-dimensional image of the sun. We start seeing a little bit more what's happening, not exactly on the backside, but at least around the corner, so to speak. Are you saying if there was a object behind the sun that we don't ordinarily see, that the stereo spacecraft would probably see them? Is that sort of what you're saying, Paul? I didn't realize that the stereos were also looking for near-Earth objects. Maybe that is what you're saying. Maybe it's not what you're saying. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
What they're doing is studying the sun. You know, so they are telescopes studying the sun. So whether or not, I mean, if they're going to move around and look this way or that way, I don't know, but if they thought anything was out there, I bet they'd find a way to utilize it. I'd have to look it up, but I mean they're out there. I mean we've got telescopes sitting there. And a few years ago, we would have had Ulysses. That was in polar orbit, and well, that got canceled maybe half a dozen years ago. But that might have seen something coming its way. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you look at the history of the Earth and the number of times we've been impacted in the last 4.5 billion years, it has happened a few times. And if you had to put an average on it, I'll bet you there's a few impacts on the Earth per billion years. And so you can't say it's absolutely impossible. It's never going to happen again. But the chances are pretty slim. I'd much rather worry about unemployment and taxes and a few other things, Vito, than this particular one. But that's me. And as you do a little bit more web searching and you read about these near-Earth object searches, these searches for unknown or known asteroids, comets, and other things that are capable of hitting the Earth, as you do those researches on the web, I think you'll find out that the chances are very, very slim. Quite a bit of researching is going on, looking for them, and I'll admit that right now there isn't a clearly defined defense mechanism. If we found that something 1 year from now of a medium good size is going to hit the Earth and it's going to create some grief, right now I'll admit that I don't think NASA or any other space agency around the world has a real defense system ready to go to do something about it. That's a little bit discouraging, but since the chances are so slim, since the degree of difficulty is so high, you can sort of see how we got into this particular state. Right now, we're looking for them, and for the most part, we ain't finding them. I think that's a good sign. Back to you, Vito. W2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Very good. I am going to look at this website and search what you had said. And yes, you did answer my question. And I've been hearing a lot of talk about this mysterious planet. And I was a little concerned, and I knew that you have a possible explanation. But I will search this further. Thank you so much. I won't tie things up. And as usual, you are most informative. So, K2RIW, WA2PJF is by for you. Thank you again, sir.
Okay. okay, Vito, as you do more research, Vito, come on back and tell us what you find. I'm far from an expert in this subject. It's just not one of my fields. I like astronomy, and I read many of the astronomy articles, but near-Earth objects is not one of the things that I've put a lot of effort into. Our next person on the list is Rich, N2EO, and Rich had a question about link coupling last week. It's going to come together again when I give this little talk on transformers and inductors, because it's related. But let's see if Rich is there first. N2EO, are you on board, Rich? K2RIW.
We did K2RIW, N2EO. Go ahead, Dick. Thank you. I sent you that schematic. I hope it was sufficient.
Yes. Your schematic of your, I think it's a Collins transmitter, I looked it over, and without a doubt, you're absolutely right, that is link coupling on the output. And as I remember, your difficulty was that you had a certain amount of power output on 2 meters, you had less power output on 6 meters, and that's what was bothering you, that the 6 meters should be easier, and why in the world was the power output less on 6? Did I remember it correctly as far as the symptoms are concerned? Rich, go ahead.
Correct, Dick. It's on 62S1 transverter. And the only reason I'm worried about a few extra watts is to drive the amplifier, which is a pair of 3500Zs, on 6 meters. Back to you, Dick.
Alrighty, as I studied that schematic, it is exactly what I was worried about, and that is pure reactive link coupling output. In other words, when you study a schematic, you find out that there is a network of inductors and capacitors, called the tuning control, on the plate circuit of this 4X150 amplifier. And then there is the coil that does the resonating for the plate circuit is link coupled to a coil that's coupled to the output connector. That link coupling has a series capacitor in that link. And one of the crazy characteristics of link coupling is that if the link that has the output connector connected to it is close enough physically to have a tight enough electronic coupling to the resonator on the plate circuit, call it a primary and a secondary of your transformer when you look at it as a schematic diagram. If there's a close enough physical spacing so you get tight enough coupling, and what usually takes place is that the variable capacitor in series with the link will give you the tightest coupling when the link is in resonance at your operating frequency. And if the link coupling is physically too tight, you can back off on the resonance by using that link coupling series capacitor slightly above the capacitance or slightly below the capacitance that gives you resonance. Now that lightens the loading. If it was too heavy, it's going to take the primary circuit and slightly knock it out of resonance, slightly higher or lower, but you can readjust that. So by rocking these two controls back and forth, you will eventually get to the condition where the plate circuit is perfectly in resonance and the coupling to the output is exactly right. That's if the link coupling is a little bit too heavy. If the link coupling is a little bit too light, then the best coupling you're going to get is when the link is resonated. And now when you take that coupled...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The link coupling capacitor, when you rock it above or below resonance, you'll be falling off in coupling coefficient. So if the physical spacing between the two coils was too light, you'd never get there. Because the control that you're operating, which is called the loading control, gives you the best loading in the middle of its control, in the middle of its range. You're not hitting maximum or minimum. You think that's the best you can do. That's the major disadvantage of link coupling. That's one of the reasons why I chose not to use it on the so-called strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles, April, May, 1972 QST. Lots of people have built that thing. There I used a capacitive coupling instead of link coupling, which doesn't have this characteristic. Now, the next question is, what's affecting your amount of coupling loading? You've got got lots of evidence that the loading on 6 meters is too light. You got about two choices. One, physically move those two coils closer together, bending the wiring, rewiring, or whatever. Getting closer, physical coupling is one approach. The second approach is to operate the tuning circuit in a higher Q mode. I believe I did see a variable inductor as well as a variable capacitor on the tuning network on the primary side. If by whatever means you can operate it with an LC ratio where the inductor is smaller and the capacitor is larger, that's a larger C to L ratio, which usually gives you a higher Q, usually gives you a larger circulating current in the primary. That larger circulating current in the primary, let me drop, will automatically give you a greater amount of electronic coupling between the primary and that secondary, which is the link output. So if there's a way you can come up with another resonance mode on the tuning network at 6 meters by varying the inductor and or capacitor, but coming back to resonance, but with a higher C to L ratio, then electronically you can get tighter coupling. So one of those techniques I think is going to do it for you. You probably know, you're more familiar with the 62S1, I think it is, whether or not there is more than one way of tuning the primary. I notice you've got a rotary switch there, as well as a variable inductor and a variable capacitor. So is there more than one way of tuning it for 6 meters? Is there another control on the inside of the cabinet that you have access to, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW, and the DECnet.
Really, Dick, it's just the tuning and loading on the... Well, what they got is sort of like a variable inductance for the plate tuning. What they've got off the coil is a... Oh, it's almost like the old inductomatch sort of arrangement. That's the right word. They've got a circular piece of metal with a wiper arm, and that's the plate tuning. As you move it, it adds and subtracts inductance. And now they do have two coils there because when you throw the switch, they throw from 6 to 2, or 2 to 6, they throw another coil in parallel with the coil that's link coupled to the output to give it more inductance on 6 meters. I guess what you're saying is I could put, would you say, less inductance, more capacitance. I could stretch out that other coil. It's only used on 6, not on 2.
I think you're on the right track. It's going to take a set of experiments, as I see it there, Rich, to either change the CL ratio on the primary circuit. Smaller inductor, larger capacitor will give you a greater amount of circulating current, and that electronically will create tighter coupling between primary and secondary. And the other is to take that link loop itself and the coil that is near, move one or the other, and it may take some remounting to do it, so that the physical distance between the two is closer. You need tighter coupling. When the coupling is tight enough, the way you'll be able to tell is that assuming your watt meter is really accurate, you'll see the greater power output. That's one condition indicating you're getting greater loading and greater coupling. Second of all, when you measure the screen current, when the plate is thoroughly dipped and resonated, if the screen current is more negative. The screen current goes more negative as the tube experiences tighter loading or out of resonance. So if in resonance, where you dip the plate, you see a more negative screen current or less positive screen current, they're really the same thing, that indicates greater loading. When you look at the screen current, when you're running key down on 6 meters versus key down on 2 meters, do you see a difference in screen current, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I really don't know. I have to look at an ammeter up in series and take a look. Right now, the only thing on the 62S1 you can monitor is plate current, grid current, and relative output.
A little bit amazed by that. Create plate current, grid current, and relative output. All right. So there is no switch position by which it monitors screen current. I think you could create one. There's various ways you can do that. Do you know of a way where you could monitor the current that the screen grid supply is supplying to the screen grid? I should know, I don't. Is there a completely separate power supply for the screen grid, or is it done by a dropping resistor from the plate circuit, if you happen to know? Back to you, Ridge.
No, they take it off the 516F2 power supply, which powers the KWM2. It's easy enough to do because they've got see-through capacitors on the PA cage in the back where the point and screen voltages are applied. All I got to do is open up that screen bypass, that see-through cap, take the wire off and insert a meter. It wouldn't be hard to do.
Okay, be careful when you do that, because you are working with probably in the vicinity of 300, 350 volts that goes on the screen of a 4X150 in full power service. And so monitoring that screen current and or voltage, in order to get full power output, you want to make sure the screen voltage is high enough, grid drive is high enough, plate circuit is loaded heavy enough. There's a whole bunch of things that are going to come together just right. Enough plate voltage, enough screen voltage. Let me think about that one. Yeah. If by some magic you could raise the screen voltage, that might help. But you're going to monitor voltages and currents and versus the tuning and loading and see whether or not you can physically move. Now, I haven't seen a photograph. You've seen the inside of that cabinet. If you had to move the link coupling closer to its primary coil, is there a way you could do that by shifting things in there physically to your memory, Rich? Go ahead.
Last summer, I spent quite a bit of time doing that. And you know what happened? The power optimized on 2 meters, but didn't come up on 6.
It'll be into 1YY. Joe recognized. We'll get to you in a second. What was the power on 2 meters before and after you did that? What was the power on 6 before and after you made that modification? Rich first. Go ahead, Rich. Okay, maybe Rich got called away. Joe?
Okay, I got a sluggish PTT. Let me use another switch. Stand by.
I was going to interject. Couldn't one monitor the screen current by looking across the screen valve, the voltage valve across the screen drop, screen resistor?
I think I'm here. I have a bad PTT. I'm back.
Yep. He doesn't have a dropping resistor in there, as I see it, Joe. He's got a completely separate power supply for screen and plate on that Collins equipment. So what was the 2 meter and 6 meter power before you made the mod and after you made the mod? Rich, N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I don't recall. It was like a year ago. I think it was about 75 watts on 2. It came up to about 90 or 95 watts. 6 meters, as I recall, just came up a smidgen. Like 5 watts, 10 watts, not even. But I did spend a lot of time optimizing that link, and that was the best I could do.
Okay, so on 2 meters, you started off at something like 60 watts, you retuned and relocated that link, and you got it up to 90 watts, significant improvement. What do you believe is the rated power output of that rig on those two bands, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, well, actually, Colin says 65 watts, 6 and 2 meters or better. But in reality, it's making spec on 6 barely. But 2 meters, it's above spec, and I've been told that a lot of these 62S1s will put out close to 100 watts on both bands. And what Joe said is very true. I could take a 1-ohm resistor, put it in series with that that feed through. And the wire, measure the dropping voltage across that. I could do that very easily, Dick. Back to you, and thank you, Joe. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Okay, Let us know how those experiments go. Sounds like you're getting almost your money's worth, but yes, it would certainly be nice to get the, let's say, 90 watts on both bands. And that way you make sure you've got more than enough drive for whatever you're going to be using as an afterburner at a later time. And the 1-ohm resistor in series with your screen grid power supply and then your digital voltmeter, completely floating. Worry about the fact that now it's got the 300 volts on both of its leads, 350 volts. Measuring the voltage drop across the 1-ohm resistor will tell you the current. And you're going to look at that current. It's going to be, in some cases, millivolts because it's milliamperes on a 1-ohm resistor. And look at the polarity. The polarity of the current is equally as important as the magnitude of the current. And as the current gets less and less positive, in other words, the power supply is where you're going to put the positive lead. The 1-ohm resistor, the red lead out of your digital voltmeter will go to the power supply end of the 1-ohm resistor. The screen grid supply, the screen grid side of the 1-ohm resistor will get the black lead. And if that meter reads positive, upscale, so to speak, that's positive current. But if it starts reading negative, keep track of that. The more negative, the heavier the loading. It either shows you that the plate circuit is out of resonance and or it's heavier in loading when it starts reading negative. So let us know how those experiments go. Next person on our list was Angel, KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo. Go right ahead, Angel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Rich. Good evening, guys in the group. I got a few questions. I built my shack. I'm about 90% done with it. So I'm in the process of putting together the grounds. I do have like a dipole coming in. And I'm going to use, I'm thinking about putting the ground protective equipment. Now, all that stuff should be inside, outside. And then my next question is, what's the proper procedure of using a crossband on US, on 2 meter 440?
Okay, when it comes to grounding our equipment, there's really three reasons we do that. The first is human safety. One of the grounding systems is the third prong on your plug that goes in the wall. If that's properly wired, that third prong, the safety wire, the green wire, goes to the chassis of your equipment, and the third prong, the round prong in the wall, should be well grounded to your fuse box and the house ground, which quite often is the water pipe if it happens to be copper. And in more modern houses, there's a completely separate ground rod outside the house. A ground rod, an EIA standard ground rod, is something like 8.5 feet long, 5/8 of an inch diameter, made out of copper or galvanized. And that rammed into the ground with the top of it below grade and the right kind of a connector on the top. It's something like a 6-gauge piece of wire coming from it to your fuse box and to your equipment. That's a very good ground. So, human safety is your primary grounding reason. Your secondary reason for that is to provide a better path if your equipment is struck with lightning. Better grounding of the equipment will give you some protection, not perfect protection. And the third reason people do grounding is they believe it lowers television interference. That one is very controversial. In many cases, just creating great grounds on your system doesn't really affect television interference. If your rig, your antenna, the shielding, the way you've got your coax cable connectors wired to the rigs and whatever, if for whatever reason you're putting a lot of RF energy on the right or the wrong frequencies into your neighbor's television set, just establishing a real good ground is going to change things, but is it really going to make it better? That's kind of skeptical. So good grounding, a guy who believes in belt and suspenders will have a completely separate grounding rod outside the shack with a 6-gauge piece of wire coming into the shack that grounds everything. That's a good safe way to go. And now that's a secondary grounding system beyond the one that's created by the plug. When it comes to running dual bands, 6 meters and 2 meters, should there be separate grounding? Should there be a different kind of grounding because you're doing that? I don't think so. And many of us put up an antenna. In our eye, we just put a brand new shiny piece of metal in the air. And in our head, we think that lightning is looking around and saying, aha, there's a shiny new piece of metal. Next time there's a thunderstorm, I'm going to strike that one. We think that way. It's really a very rare event. I've got 100 feet of tower. I'm sitting on 300 feet above sea level, a hill in Huntington. And my 100-foot tower, I think I had a nearby strike once of the power line in the 40 years that I've been living here. I should be struck all the time. My tower sticks up above the trees. Normally your trees are taller. If you really looked with the right kind of eyes that can see wiring, let me drop it. And you look down on your community, you're going to see all kinds of distribution wiring of Con Ed and LIPA and LOCO. That wiring running up and down all of the streets, wiring all the houses, and all those telephone poles have got a grounded lead on the top of those telephone poles. That's a huge network of grounds around your property. Lightning would much rather strike that than to strike your little antenna. My antenna happens to stick up above those LIPA grounds. And as I said, the one case where I did seem to have lightning damage, the majority of the damage was computers and televisions in another room, not in the ham shack. So I have strong reason to believe, and my neighbors also had refrigerators and television sets and computers that got damaged. So it looks like that one lightning strike that we had about 10 or 12 years ago was a power line strike, not a tower strike, from all I can tell. No other damage of ham radio equipment took place. So lightning is something to be concerned about. There are certain places on Long Island, like there's a particular place in Glen Cove, where my grandfather used to have a farm, and that farmhouse and his barns got struck very periodically. He was up on top of the hill in Glen Cove, and for whatever reason, just the way that lay of the land took place, it seems like every year there was one lightning strike on his property that would create a fire in one of his wooden buildings. So, except for rare cases like that, lightning is nowhere near as much to worry about. If you're real super conservative guy, whenever you know a lightning storm is coming, you disconnect all the coax cables from all of your equipment. Some guys do that. Back to you, Angel. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment from Vito.
Yeah, stand by, Angel. Go ahead, Vito.
One of the most important things about grounding, if you were to be hit by lightning, it's graduation day, as we already know. But the things I teach the individual customers at Home Depot in reference to grounding is one primary issue. The reason why I emphasize grounding in general is that there's an old saying that lightning strikes from the ground up, meaning that the negative, lightning is DC. The negative charges that are floating around in the sky with these step leaders and the positive charges that are on the ground are always trying to close or make contact with each other. Let me drop. So what we do is we ground as much as we can structures, buildings, whatever it may be, through ground rods. And the reason being is to lower, I use the word lower, the reaching action of the positive charges reaching up into the sky. We use a simple terminology, up into the air. If these positive charges on the ground are as low as possible, not, let's use some silly juvenile terminology, not visible to the negative side or the negative charges in the air that are passing through during an electrical storm, then a strike will not be completed. But if these positive charges are reaching up high enough, then the negative charges, of course, will make contact and we have a strike. Many customers in the store at Home Depot, let me drop, coming with this crazy idea of putting light fixtures on trees. I say, no, do not do that, because the tree is very high into the air above ground, could be 100 feet up plus, and this tree is very vulnerable to a possibility of a strike or an electrical contact during a storm. And, of course, this will be transmitted to into your light fixture and the wiring brought into your home, and a fire condition is very possible. So I always tell them the scenario about the positives and negatives method, what's happening here, and keeping these positives as low as possible through grounding. We only make an attempt to keep that as low as we can, but if we're unsuccessful, as happens all the time, then a strike will prevail. And yes, you did make mention about the highest wire on a utility pole, and that wire, of course, is primarily there for the to take a hit or strike if should prevail, to possibly protect what is below that. So back to you, Dick, if I may. I'm sorry to be a Mr. Know-it-all. Go ahead.
Stop worrying, Vito. Good information. Everybody from Ben Franklin on down has given some recommendations, and I think the Polyphaser catalog. Polyphaser is a company that makes lightning arrestors. I think they live in Nevada. They talk about a lightning arrestor as a kind of a pointy object you put on top of the building with some real good grounding wiring going between it and a good earth ground. And the whole purpose for doing that is that if lightning is going to strike the building, you'd like it to strike this metallic lightning arrestor, be conducted to ground, as opposed to flowing through the wooden portions of the building and potentially creating a fire. So in this particular case, installing a lightning arrestor on top of the building, and many buildings do this, both private homes and industrial buildings, there you're raising those positive charges from the ground to a higher altitude. There are people who think that that lightning arrestor will sometimes do, by way of the corona coming off of it, local discharging, so the lightning strike doesn't take place. But if one does take place, it's now got a clearly defined parallel path around your building and around your sensitive equipment. So keeping the positive charge low to the ground is sort of what you were saying, Vito. I think it's a good thing to do, but it's a slight conflict of interest with installing a lightning arrestor. And quite a few of the fire protection codes for places like New York City do recommend a lightning arrestor. Also, if you go to certain websites, you'll see that certain broadcast towers and communication towers do have an intentional sharp, pointy object near the top intended as a lightning arrestor. You might want to comment on that one, Vito. WA2PJF, K2RIW.
It's okay. There are ground rods and there are lightning rods. There's a building, an old house, not too far from where I live. And it was a an old railroad person back in the 1800s. It's called the Cutting Arbitrarium here in East Islip. And I've been to that building, a very beautiful home, but again, turn of the century. And on top of this building, on top of, there are seven chimneys, seven stacks. Reason being that the home was primarily heated by a fireplace facility. And every one of those stacks has several rods sticking up into the air, several feet up, and it must be, oh, I'm guessing maybe a 1-aught or a 2-aught copper, which is all green now from copper sulfate, wire from each of those rods going down the building across the roof and so forth to ground rods. It's a direct path to ground. And it's only there to, if the building were to be hit by lightning, let me drop. It's a cut and dried arrangement, no sophisticated equipment, lightning arrestors and so forth. This is a straight path, and to divert the lightning from hitting the building and starting a fire. Of course, I am a little concerned about the idea of these bare wires, by the way, laying on the roofs of the colossus building structure that, in essence, could start a fire. But it's still standing, and I'm willing to bet it was hit many times. So this is what it is. It's a ground rod and a lightning rod. The lightning rod is up on top of the building, out there reaching. If you notice, there are many power plants, and there's one in Freeport and many others. Freeport generates its own power, I believe, and there are many of these lightning rods sticking up into the sky, up into the air, above the equipment, solely for the fact of being the highest thing around that area, if need be, to attract these bolts of lightning, and hopefully suppressing them, guiding them down to ground safely. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, some of these power plants have a local, very tall chimney of some kind, and I think many of those have a lightning arrestor on the top, because if the lightning was striking even a concrete chimney, it's capable of blasting away some of the mortar and brick and whatever. To conduct that with a lightning arrestor metallic system to ground is a safe thing to do. Lightning protection is not an easy one, as you probably already know, Angel. There's no ideal solution. No matter what you do when it comes to protecting your computing equipment and your television sets and other things in the house, if the power line outside your house really does take a direct hit, all the things you do are going to lessen the damage, but you can never guarantee there'll never be no damage. Each one of these things we do is a step in the right direction. By the same token, no matter how many locks you put on your house, if a burglar is really hell-bent to get into your house, there's a way to do it. If your house is on fire, the firemen could get into your house. They may have to bore a hole in the side of one of the walls, but they'll get into your house, if you know what I mean. Nothing is perfect. But all of these things are a deterrent. They all help. Back to you, Angel. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger there. Well, I'm coming to the conclusion that I'm going to ask this, but I'm coming to the conclusion that I can't share a ground. And if I do, I might have to put something, some kind of to choke the voltage so it won't come into my other system. Is that correct?
I'm going to check with Vito on this one. I believe that if you installed a ground for your radio system, and if you tied it in parallel with the ground for your fuse panel for your house, I think that's not bad. I think the more grounds, the better. The more they're interconnected, the better. I see no reason why a ground outside the radio shack, which may be in the first bedroom of the house or the second bedroom, and another ground that's established for the drop from Con Ed into your house and into the fuse panel, and if you tie those grounds together, I don't think that's bad. I think, if anything, it could be good. I think they support each other. I wonder what is the recommendation along those lines by Home Depot, Vito, WA2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's a negative on that. I'm talking about sharing the ground. I have a shack in the back that I made, so I'm asking, should I share the ground with my radio equipment protection and the lighting protection? So there's two different systems right there. And if I do get a lighting, it will come into my system, so I need to choke the voltage coming in that one direction.
K2
Yeah, let's see what Bernie's got to say on this one. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
Angel, I think you need to look at it from a slightly different paradigm. You are sharing the ground. The ground is ground outside your shack. So you may have two different ground rods, but they are interconnected by the dirt in between them. I believe that code says those should be bonded together.
I'm not the expert in this. I know you work in the electrical field. You could probably find some of your coworkers who may have some good knowledge in this area, but I believe that NEC says those have to be bonded together. At the very least, they are subtly bonded together by the ground in between them, the ground in the case, meaning the dirt in between them.
Good information, Bernie. We heard everything you said, but you should know that your audio is at least 10 decibels lower than everyone else. You've got to either shout into that mic or get the water out of it or whatever. So tying grounds together, even though he's got a completely separate building for his ham shack, and to have a local ground at the ham shack is a very good recommendation. But if you decide to tie that ground back to the house ground, I don't think it's a disadvantage. I think it's an advantage to tie them together. That's what I believe Bernie is saying. And let's find out what Vito is saying by way of the recommendation of Home Depot. WA2PJF, K2RIW. Go ahead, Vito.
Okay. Most important, we have to keep in mind grounds. Now, they could be detrimental. For example, before I get involved in what Angel's speaking of, many customers come into the store, they want to put sub-panels outside in a garage or a building away from their home via underground PVC, polyvinyl chloride, housings through THHN, thermoplastic high-heat nylon conductors. What needs to be done at the building away from the home is that the ground, the term called grounding, I-N-G, and grounded, E-D. The grounded is the neutral wire, and the grounding, I-N-G, is the bare conductor. Keeping in mind that the white neutral wire that is covered for a reason, being that the white grounded wire carries current. That's why it's covered. What happens at a main panel is that the grounding and grounded conductors are tied together either on the same bus or separate bus bars through a link from one bus bar to the other through the under the bus bars that carry phase A and B. But they are separated at the sub panel. Let me drop. I'm building up to something. That's why I'm giving this explanation. They are separated at the sub panel. Reason being that should the neutral wire come loose from its connector at the sub panel out in the yard somewhere, that means now if the grounded and grounding wire were to be tied together, the bare wire, the grounding conductor, will now carry the return to the main panel at the home. Meaning that all of the appliances, the water pipes and so forth in the home will now become energized. So that is why they're separated, not tied together. Should it come loose, everything at the sub panel will shut down. Now, being very careful when you're putting a grounding circuit at a building, a ham shack out in your yard, we need to keep in mind, wherever possible, to keep away from the utility circuits for the same reasons I had just mentioned. Let me drop. I don't like the idea of tying any type of radio equipment or foreign grounding or whatever it may be with being associated with the utility company. That's another integer entirely. We're talking high currents here. High currents, okay? Transformers on poles and so forth. I don't like the idea of being associated with that. In the telephone company, which I'm retired from, we were told continuously in various courses that we would take to provide our own grounding facility. We go to a water pipe in a basement. We do not go near a utility facility. We never tie a ground to a black pipe. A black pipe usually signifies a gas line. We're now inviting an explosion. Grounding is very, very critical. There's all different aspects to grounding, and there's a lot of theory and a lot of knowledge that you have to understand. There's a big school of thought with grounding. And thinking that you're doing something good, let me drop. Thinking that you're doing the right thing, you could be generating or creating a hazardous explosive condition, depending what you tie it to. Usually I've learned that the best grounding is an independent ground. I have seven antennas outside my house and a radio tower, and I have about 12 or 14 ground rods buried 8 feet long into the ground. All of my grounding is independent. It's by itself, solely being placed for the amateur radio equipment, not associated in any way with any other grounding inside of my building, whether it be water pipes, utilities, whatever it may be. They're completely by themselves. So that gives me a gap, a separation between point A and point B, that if something were to happen, a strike of lightning at my radio facilities, it will not be affecting the household facilities, pipelines and power lines, television, etc. I have a separation of both. This is what I've been learning. This is what I've been taught. We take courses in the store. Working for Home Depot. Hang on. Let me drop. Working for Home Depot is like going to school each day. It is mandatory we take courses, whether it be a professor or a whomever talking to us, or it's on computers or whatever. We are required each month to have X amount of PKs. PKs, product knowledge. And we have to study these things. And when the customer comes in the store and he has a question, we have to give him an answer that's correct, because Home Depot feels, and they could be, liable for the answer that Vito gives to Joe or Sam, who comes in with a question about whatever. And if I give the wrong information, they can legally come back to us and say, that moron Vito told me this, and I'm suing Home Depot, and it could happen. So these are things we've learned from our PK courses, and I'm giving along, passing along to this net. So back to you, Dick, if I may. Go ahead.
I heard Bernie, and who is the other person that we doubled with?
WGB.
Okay. Let's go to Bernie, who's going to speak louder into his mic, and then John in that order. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I'll do it the best I can. I apologize and I'll keep it short. I disagree with what Vito just said, and my knowledge comes from Don, whose last name I'm not going to be able to come up with, who's an engineer that specifically works in the area of grounding systems. My message to Angel is go to Ham Radio University coming up in January, and Don will be speaking there. There'll be a whole hour worth of grounding and how to do it all. The point is that Vito was saying that he does not have his radio ground interfaced with his building ground. The problem is that if he takes a direct strike on his antenna and it is radiated into the ground, that the ground for probably 20 or 30 feet around that ground rod is going to be at elevated potential. You're now going to have two different ground potentials. If your antenna is still connected to your radio, one ground is going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of volts higher than the other one. And I believe this is why they say to bond those two together. So my understanding is that all of the grounds in the building, RF and safety grounds, all have to be bonded together somewhere out in your grounding field.
I can see this is not simple. And Each installation, I think, is unique, and the ideal solution for lightning is a real tough. I'm pretty sure that the polyphaser book. I've got to look at the polyphaser book again. I think it's going to give us some of these details. I know that the people in Toad Hill, I think it's pronounced in Richmond County, better known as Staten Island. I'm sure you guys get lightning. I guarantee you guys have come up with some techniques. I know that in your business, you had an awful lot of lightning protection that you personally installed, John. So tell us your point of view on this one. KC2 WGB K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm KC2.
Eric's going to be after John. John first, go ahead.
KC2 WGB. Good evening, Dick. Basically, what Vito said is correct. Now, the thing that Angel has to do is drive an independent ground rod for his shack and connect that to his supply panel, his little distribution panel that he has in there, on the green wire ground, which is actually the ground connection to the panel itself. Okay, now if he has PVC pipe feeding it, there's a ground wire in there that goes back to the original fifth jaw connections to ground. Fine, there's no problem. If it's EMT, it wouldn't be EMT underground, but if it's galvanized, he has a ground already connected to the panel. But the ground rod goes in outside of the shack, all the ground connections are outside, bring a lead in and ground the panel at the green wire bond, just like Vito said. Then he can connect his tower or his antennas or anything to the ground, but all of those grounds should be outside of the building. You don't want to bring lightning in, never. But basically what Vito was saying is correct.
I hear you.